minds. Now, way back in January, we talked about the first period of Old Testament history. And everybody remember what we call that? Pre-flood, right? So, I'm sorry, this isn't showing up very well. It'll get later. It'll get better later on, don't worry. I apologize for that. It looked fine on my iPad. It does not look so good on this screen. But the first period is pre-flood, right? In February, we talked about the second period, which is post-flood, right? And then in March, we talked about the third period, patriarchal. And patriarchal covers everything from Abraham to the fourth period, which lasted for about 430 years, but we have very little written about, which is about which period? In April, what did we talk about? You remember? Bondage in Egypt, right? The 430 years in which the children of Israel were slaves in the land of Egypt. Now, after that comes the period of wandering, right? The 40 years that Israel wandered in the desert before they were able to engage in the conquest, right? And that was about a five-year period, about the war that Joshua led the children of Israel on to destroy and conquer the fortified cities in the land of Canaan. So after the conquest in the month of July, we spoke about which period of Old Testament history? The Judges, right? That period lasted for about 350 years from the time of Joshua's death all the way until the United Kingdom, right? Saul, David, and Solomon. But after Solomon dies, because of both his sin and his son Rehoboam's sin, the kingdom divides, right? We get to a divided kingdom. And that's what we talked about 2 months ago. So last month, we addressed the 10th period in which the nation of Israel is destroyed in 722 BC. And for a little over 100 years after that, alone of God's people, Judah remains in the promised land. And so that was last month. And so this month, captivity or the exile, right? Captivity or the exile. I've heard it both ways. The one we have in our list is the captivity. I guess I'm calling it the exile in my sermon. But it's the same thing. It's the 70 years during which the balance of the inhabitants of the kingdom of Judah were taken away to Babylon, and they lived there as slaves of first the Babylonian and later the Medo-Persian Empire. And so after this happens, after these 70 years are passed, the children of Judah are allowed to return back home and begin the long process of restoration. Right. So this is essentially Old Testament history in a nutshell. So, as we've said, this morning we're going to be talking about lessons from the captivity or lessons from the exile. And so when we think about these 70 years, we actually don't have a whole lot written about them. We have the Book of Lamentations, which is basically just a poetic I told you so regarding these 7 years. That's really all it's about. And then we have some of the Book of Ezekiel happens before the exile. Some of it happens during the exile. Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther are all after the exile. They're all during the period that we would call the restoration. But during the exile, pretty much the book, with, and a lot of Ezekiel is apocalyptic narrative, which is highly couched in metaphor, and where he's talking about the coming of the church. So really about these 70 years, I mean, one of the books that actually has the most for us is the Book of Daniel. And when we talk about the Book of Daniel, we talk about lessons to learn from the exile in the Book of Daniel. Which characters do we usually think of? There's four, right? We usually think of four. We usually think of Daniel. That one's kind of a no-brainer because the book's named after him, right? We usually think of Daniel. And then we usually think of the other three together, right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But their names are really Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's the names they were born with. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are their Sumerian names. They're not their Hebrew names. Those are the names that Nebuchadnezzar gave us, which leads us to the character I actually want to talk about this morning. I want to talk about Nebuchadnezzar today. I want to go sort of the other route. Because it was actually not too long ago where I actually talked about Daniel, and I delivered one sermon about a bunch of different lessons that we can learn from his life. And not long after I got here, over a year ago, I did a lesson about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. And so, I mean, we're here, we're in this period, and so we have to talk about this period. But a lot of times we look at Daniel and we look at the lessons in the book of Daniel and we go, oh, faith, obedience. Yes, I've done those sermons, so please don't get me wrong. Those are absolutely important and necessary lessons we learn from it. But at the same time, we're neglecting a whole other host of lessons that we could learn by talking about the other side. Just as it is important for us to look at good, positive examples of how we should behave and the kind of things we should do, and the great, tremendous example that Daniel sets for us in every aspect of his behavior during his exile in Babylon, it's also crucially important for us to look at people who totally botched it. People who just got up and just rammed their heads face-long into that brick wall over and over and over and over again. The Apostle Paul himself said, never, 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 never forget what happened to the Israelites when they were in the desert. Never forget that. Because the things that were written down about them and the mistakes they made were written down for us to learn from. And so the biggest lesson that I can think of, the biggest lesson that I draw from the life of Nebuchadnezzar, sort of taking a step back and looking at all of it as a whole, is what happens when leaders forget to serve. There, that one's a little easier to see, right? What happens when leaders forget to serve? I think that's the lesson we learned from Nebuchadnezzar as a whole. And there's this whole evolution that he goes through, and this process that he undergoes that gets him to the point that Darius read this morning. I'd like for us to go back to our scripture reading this morning, back to Daniel chapter 4. And so these are going to be our lessons from the exile. Daniel chapter 4. And we're going to look at verse 28 through 31 again. All of this came upon Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered, and he said, is this not great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you this is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you. When we look at the context of all of this, that scripture reading that Darius gave us this morning starts out with this, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. And the all of this, it's important for us to understand what all of this was. What the all of this was this dream that he had where he is sitting there and he's at ease in his palace and he dreams and he has this dream and none of the astrologers or the enchanters or the magicians of his kingdom can answer. And so finally he calls Daniel before him and he tells Daniel the dream. And the dream is essentially this. The interpretation of the dream is essentially this. Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to become great. You're going to become mighty, and you're going to become powerful, and you're going to become the greatest ruler on the world. And then it's all going to get taken away from you. You're going to wander around like a beast in the field. You're going to become insane. You're going to eat grass with your mouth. How many of us like the taste of, how many of us have tasted grass? How many of us who have tasted grass like the taste of grass? How many of us would get down on our fours and chomp at it like a cow? Only if we were totally insane. And Daniel, who has so much respect for Nebuchadnezzar and who understands that Nebuchadnezzar is the least of bad options at the moment, when Daniel hears this dream and he talks to this king, he weeps and he says, I wish this was meant for your enemies and not for you. Because after you become the greatest man on the earth, it's going to get taken away. And everything's going to come crashing down on your head and you're going to become a vagabond and you're going to become homeless and you're going to wander around in the fields like an animal. And it's that brings us to the scripture reading this morning. The king is sitting here and he's looking at, oh, look how great and how awesome I am. And look at how wonderful I am. And look at how powerful my majesty and my might is. And look what I have done. I want for us to back up to verse 4 of chapter 4 and look at how Nebuchadnezzar starts off this. I mean, because the interesting thing about this is chapter 4 is actually something that Nebuchadnezzar wrote himself. There's a portion of the book of Daniel that Daniel did not write. Nebuchadnezzar wrote it, and that's chapter 4. This is Nebuchadnezzar's writing. These are Nebuchadnezzar's words. Chapter 4 starts off with a praise to God, and then he, in verse 4, he says, let me tell you this thing that happened to me, this story that happened to me that's important for you to understand. He says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house, and I was prospering in my palace. And this is how this path begins. We get comfortable and we relax. Leaders who are in this position, and I mean, this could be elders in the church, it could be the president of the United States, it doesn't matter. Anyone in a position of leadership, this is the warning sign. This is how all of this begins. We get comfortable and we start to relax and we start to think that everything that has been accomplished is ours, that we deserve the credit, that is all ours, that all the things that have done have been done in our name and by our hand and by our power, and we deserve it. Because here you have Nebuchadnezzar relaxing in his palace and everything's at ease, and he looks and he surveys his kingdom, and what does he say about his kingdom? Look at all of the great things that I own, and look at how great I am because of that. This starts with the focus. I mean, who's Nebuchadnezzar focusing on right now? He's focusing on himself, right? This is the obvious thing. He's focusing on himself. I was relaxing in my palace, in my house. I looked at my kingdom, and I said, look at how mighty I am and how great my majesty is and how awesome and powerful my throne is. And that's when this madness strikes him. And he becomes insane, and he starts living in the fields, and he's homeless, and he's a vagabond, and he eats grass like an animal. And his physical appearance even becomes distorted in his madness. But the fascinating thing is, I say this is where it starts, and it kind of is where it starts, but he got to this place somehow. And so it's the journey that he goes on to get to this mindset that actually, to me, is the fascinating thing. Because we look at this and we analyze this, we pick apart even the first part of this dream that he has about how great this tree is that he has in his vision and his dream. And we understand because we're looking at it through the lens of scriptural narrative, right? We're looking at it through the lens of what the Bible records about the history. And we understand that the one who's responsible for making Nebuchadnezzar great is God. That he's the one who actually builds Nebuchadnezzar up to this point. I mean, God is the one who said, I'm sending the Babylonians to the prophet Habakkuk to punish Judah for their idolatry and for their iniquity, for their lawlessness. And Habakkuk is, you got to be crazy. They're worse than everybody else. Well, I'm going to take care of them too. Well, what are you talking about? So we understand God is the one who's doing this. Because we're looking at it through that lens at this moment. But the fact is, when we're in the middle of events and we're caught up in things, sometimes we forget to look at it through that lens. Sometimes we forget to have this perspective that we ought to have. And sometimes we start thinking that it's because of us and because of our greatness. Or even if we read about something or if we hear something, let's put ourselves in Nebuchadnezzar's position for a minute. Let's actually look at how he got to this place. And how he gets to this place goes all the way back to the beginning of the book. This path that he's on and this road that he takes, all the way back to the beginning of the book. Let's look all the way back at Daniel chapter 2. This whole relationship between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar starts back here. Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and he can't figure out what it is. And so he says, in order to figure out who's actually telling me the truth, I'm not going to tell you what the dream is. You're going to have to tell me what the dream is and give me its interpretation, and then I'll believe that the gods have spoken to you about it. So he does this, and they go through the entire the entire pool of magicians and soothsayers that are in the royal court of Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar says, fine, I'm just going to kill them all because nobody can tell me what my dream is. And so Daniel hears about this, and he goes to the person who's in charge of him, who his overseer is, and he says, tell the king not to do that. I'll tell him what his dream is, and I'll tell him what the dream means. So this is the statue dream, right? That we all are probably those of us who are students of the scripture are familiar with, where there's the head of gold, and then there's the torso and the arms of silver, and then there's the thighs of bronze and the iron and then iron and clay, right? And then this great mountain of a rock comes and smashes it all to pieces. And we always say, this is talking about the church. Yes, it absolutely is. That's the kingdom of God that will never be destroyed. But put yourself in Nebuchadnezzar's place when you're hearing about this dream. What do you hear about yourself? You hear that you are the best. You hear that you are the golden head. You hear that you are majestic and powerful and rich. And that all these things, everyone who comes after you is going to be less than you are. That's what you hear. That's what Nebuchadnezzar processes. He says, ah, I am favored by the gods. And he begins to act like it. He begins to take this for granted. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. And Nebuchadnezzar sits and he thinks to himself, that's me. I am that majestic. I am that powerful. The gods have blessed me, and they're on my side, so I can do anything I want. And this is really where that path has its birth. Is Nebuchadnezzar had a sense of entitlement. And he shows it throughout the rest of his life. The next big event that we read about happens in chapter 3. And it's about that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego episode. And that whole scenario starts off because Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue made of gold. And he sets it up in the plain of Shinar. And he has all these people gather around it. And they have to bow down and worship whenever they hear the sounds of all these various musical instruments. And he says, bow down and worship this image. And I have a few interesting questions. I mean, here's the thing that's fascinating to me. Here's where all of this becomes connected, okay? Nebuchadnezzar hears about the first dream from Daniel, and he hears that he is gold. So what does he build his statue out of? Gold. And I wonder what face was on that statue. And I wonder, maybe it just might have been Nebuchadnezzar's himself. Just maybe. When you hear the sounds of all these instruments, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And by worshiping the image, I mean, we can see that we're really worshiping the person who put up the image as well. And that Nebuchadnezzar begins to behave as if he is this great, majestic, powerful, wonderful figure, and that he is the one who deserves credit for all of these glorious things his kingdom has accomplished. And he's not remembering who put him there. Because the thing is, in that dream where he saw that statue the first time, Daniel told him who put him there. Daniel told him why he was this powerful in the first place. And Daniel told him also why the kingdoms that were going to come after him might be more militarily powerful, but their grandeur would often be less. The thing that has happened to Nebuchadnezzar's brain at this point is he's forgotten something. He's forgotten the purpose of leadership. He's forgotten what a leader is there to do. There's love or hate Mel Gibson. There are some great lines in some of his movies. And I want to bring up one line. Forgive me for the pop culture reference, but Paul used them occasionally. So there's a line in the movie Braveheart where the character that Mel Gibson plays is confronting the nobles of Scotland. And he says to them, they're in the middle of an argument about who deserves to be king of Scotland, and they're fighting each other. They start standing up, and they start yelling at each other, and he just walks out on this whole situation. And one of the nobles says to him, you know, Sir William, where are you going? He says, you've forgotten something. You think the people of this country exist to give you position. I think your position exists to give the country of this people freedom, and I'm going to make sure that they have it. The thing that is trying to be taught in that scene is that leaders first have to serve. The position of leadership exists to provide other people with service and things that they need. And lest we think I'm going totally off the rails with my Braveheart quote, this is exactly what John 13 is teaching. You've got this image of Jesus, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the Messiah, God himself made flesh, dressing like a slave and doing the worst, most literally stinky and smelly, and also metaphorically stinky and smelly job that a slave had to do. He has to wash people's dusty, dirty, foul-smelling feet after a long journey on the road. And these people are not wearing socks and shoes, they're wearing sandals. How many of us have worn sandals and hiked through the dirt for a long, extended period of time? Okay, what do your feet look like after that? Do you even want to touch them in the shower? I wouldn't even want to touch my own feet in the shower after that. But what Jesus does is he gets down and he washes all 12 guys of these. This is the lesson, the example that Jesus sets for us. And this is not what Nebuchadnezzar, of course, Jesus hadn't come around yet by this time, but there have been several other standards of leadership that have been set, even among the pagan and Gentile world where this has been talked about, but it completely escapes his mind. And this is the thing that happens to us as human beings. And this is not special to him. This is not special to the pagan world. There have been times and there have been places where people who claim to be godly have this perspective. There was a place that we used to worship. I was a very, very, very young child at the time, so I don't really remember this all that well. But there was a preacher who had sort of ramrodded his way into the eldership. And a lot of unsavory things happened in the middle of that process. And this went completely over my head at the time, but what I have been told by multiple sources is this man would get up and from the pulpit say that you wouldn't know who Jesus was without me. You owe me your salvation. He would say that. You owe your salvation to me. I'm the cause of all this thing, so you owe me everything I want for you to give me. This is a tremendously demonic sense of entitlement. Because I owe my salvation to nobody but Jesus. Now, someone might have taught me, and I might be grateful for them teaching me, and I might show my gratitude, but the reason they taught me, if they're doing it for the right reasons, is because they owe Jesus. And so because of his majesty and his power and his might and his love and mercy and compassion, they want to share that message with everybody else, so they don't take credit for it. Jesus said to his disciples, after you've done everything that you've been instructed to do, after you've done everything that's righteous and people praise you for it, what you say to them is not, you owe your salvation to me. What you say to them is, we are unworthy slaves who have only done that which we ought to have done. And this is what Nebuchadnezzar does not see. And so we get to that point in verse 28, where all of this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. What has happened to him by this point is his father conquered Assyria and forged the beginnings of an empire, and he took that and he ran with it, and he expanded his borders, and he conquered 20 times the territory his father did. All the way to the western end of the Fertile Crescent, right up to the very border of Egypt itself. And he pushed east into modern-day Iran, Persia. And he began to conquer territory there. And he grew wealthy, he grew mighty, and he grew powerful. And he has this soothsayer, this young man who's a magician, it seems like, from this other nation far to the west at the very frontier of his empire come and tell him after this dream that troubles him that even the foreign god has blessed him. And he starts to create a legend around that, and he believes it. And he says, look at me and look at how wonderful I am and look at how mighty and powerful I've become, and everybody on the earth should bow down to me. Because someone told him he was good once. And he started to think he was the best. This is, at least to me, this kind of hits home. Because we look at men like this and we say, oh, those are worldly, pagan, ungodly people. We don't do that. And even the other guy I was talking about earlier, oh, we're not going to be like that because he wasn't really a Christian in the first place. So we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. If there's anyone who is susceptible to this kind of behavior, it's preachers and elders. We are the prime victims and perpetrators of this. Because we have people come to us and we do these things and we engage in whatever. I get up and I deliver my sermons. We have our elders who shepherd the flock and guide them. And people who are under good elders know that they're under good elders, and they show gratitude and they show respect. And it's really easy for us to get used to that. And it's really easy for us to think that that's the way it ought to be and to think that that's the way things should be. And we go from there to saying, not, I preach for this congregation, but this is my congregation, and I preach for them. I couldn't tell you how many times I've been places, a lot of them overseas, but some of them here, where I've heard a preacher say, my congregation. They've said that. Sometimes I know they don't mean it. I know what they mean is the congregation where I'm preaching, right? The congregation I serve. But sometimes I've heard people say, my congregation, and I know that they really mean my congregation because they think it belongs to them. They think that they possess this group of people. Now, I enjoy your compliments. I do because it tells me I'm doing something right. I enjoy receiving positive feedback because it's encouraging me. It helps me understand that I'm of use to you, that I'm serving you in somehow. But at the same time, I myself have this burden on me to not allow myself to get used to that so much. So if you have some criticism for me that you think I would profit from that may not be the most complimentary, please give it to me. Because that helps put things in perspective. And it helps keep me humble, and it helps me avoid things like this. Because the danger is all too easy to succumb to for all of us. Because we can get used to being the great one, the one in charge. Because we've forgotten that even the people who lead have to follow. So Nebuchadnezzar succumbs to this madness, and he's out there and he's eating like an animal. And his countenance has become twisted. He's grown things, facial hair, long nails. He's become almost like an animal physically as a result of this. And he's living in abject humiliation because here's everybody who is a part of his court laughing at him, mocking him, saying, look at what happened to that guy. And it's not until the part of his brain that's still human, so to speak, finally realizes all of this that God allows him to sort of wake up. Because there's this part of his brain that's processing all of this, and he comes to this epiphany, and that is when his countenance changes, his appearance goes back to being normal, shall we say. And his mind becomes clear, and he
He regains his humanity, and he goes back, and he cleans himself up, and he washes himself. And he's come to this realization about who he is and what, how he has to lead and what he needs to do as king. At the end of these days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? In verse 34 of chapter 4. It's only when he looks back in the right place that he begins to understand the reality of the situation. Because the whole problem with this process, with this evolution, the whole reason why all of these things happen is because leaders who are in this position who fall into this, what they're doing is they're looking down at the people below them. And that's what gives them this misguided view of how great and how high and exalted they are, is because they're always looking down. And they forget to look up back to God. And it's only when we really do that that we see how great the gap is, how I might think that I'm up here, but next to God, I am nothing. And there's an interesting turn of phrase that happens there. Once I looked, lifted my eyes to heaven, then my reason returned to me. And he says, I blessed the Most High and praised him and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the hosts of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can say to his hand or say to him, what have you done? And the last verse of the chapter. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and honor the King of heaven. For all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. The thing is, we talk about this, and I've said, I think somewhat honestly, that preachers and elders, and at least within the church, are the people who are most vulnerable and susceptible to this. And I think that's honest. But at the same time, we're all vulnerable to this. Because greatness and self-exaltation doesn't just happen to people who lead. It might happen more often and more frequently and to a greater degree of magnitude to those who lead, but it can happen to everybody. Anyone can look and say to themselves, how great I am. And all we have to do is look to the person next to us and look at all of their flaws and pretend that we don't have any. How many of us have thought to ourselves, I'm a better Christian than that person is? How many of us have done that? Okay, be honest. Probably everybody in the room. And that may be true. That may be true. Until the moment you start to think that and you allow pride to dwell in your heart and you allow any assessment of whether or not you're a better Christian than that person is, when you allow that assessment to give you a sense of entitlement over that person, I deserve more than this person deserves because I'm better than they are. I said leaders are the most susceptible. We're just the most susceptible. Everybody is susceptible. All of us struggle against this self-exaltation, this pride, this building up of ourselves and of and the putting down of other people. And we stand here and we say, oh, look at me and look at how great and look at how wonderful we are. And we forget one thing. All of us, every single person on earth, is a slave. All of us. In 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul paints a very, very interesting picture. He says, Christ leads us in triumphal procession. And we talked about that on Wednesday night in Bible class. And I want to borrow that this morning. Christ leads us in triumphal procession. And there's a really interesting thing going on in the imagery that Paul uses when he does this, is because he paints a picture of a Roman triumph, a Roman parade of victory. And this is really where we get our parades to celebrate any occasion that we have, as we go back to the Roman tradition. And what happens in a Roman triumph is that you have a victorious general leading the procession sort of at the front. And what you have in this victory, this triumph, is you have this Roman general being honored as if he is a god for that day. And directly behind him, what we have are we have the conquered and the captured slaves, usually the leadership that have been vanquished, the kings and the nobles of the vanquished people. And the crowd is encouraged to throw rotten vegetables and rotten eggs and excrement and urine at them as they're going through. And it's in this context that Paul talks about the stench of death. And that's what these conquered slaves smelled like by the time this parade was done. And a lot of times at the end of the parade, they were executed for public entertainment. But directly behind them, you have the most valorous, the most courageous, the most decorated of the general's army. And then you have the rest of the soldiers, sort of in the last block that goes on. But the fascinating thing is about all of this is that you've got these conquered slaves, right? And then you have the soldiers who themselves are slaves. They're slaves to their unit and they're slaves to the empire. Roman soldiers were tattooed like a slave was tattooed. They were branded. Now, the common belief is they were branded with SPQR, the Senate and People of Rome. That's actually not correct. They were branded or tattooed on their forearm with their unit number and designation, marking their status of slavery until their 20 years of servitude was up. And the fascinating thing in that imagery is that you have Christ, the triumphant general, leading his victorious army, and also the conquered and the vanquished. But everybody in that parade is a slave. Even the victorious, even the decorated and honored and exalted, they are still slaves. And even while this general is marching through the streets leading this procession and being honored as a god for the day, in his chariot right next to him, there is one of his own personal slaves whispering in his ear, "Remember, you are but a man." Even he is humbled in this event. That's what all of us need to remember. Leaders and everybody else. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's what Nebuchadnezzar forgot. He forgot that leadership begins with service. That's what we can never forget. That's what we have to remember every single day of our life. That we are here to serve God, and we serve God by serving other people. That's what Jesus says. He says, when people come to me in this judgment, I'm going to say to them, I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was naked, you clothed me, etc. And they're going to say, when did we do this? Well, you did it to other people, so you did it to me. And I'm going to say to other people, you didn't do this. Well, when did we see you? Well, you didn't do it to other people, so you didn't do it to me. The greatest calling that we have is to give of ourselves and to remember, not to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to, as Paul writes in Philippians 2, but to think of others as if they're more important than we are. To remember that all of us are here to serve. If you'd like to become a slave this morning, to give your life in service to Jesus and in service to his brothers and sisters, our brothers and sisters in Christ, and to the rest of humanity as well, we have the means. You can be immersed into Christ, immersed in water. You can die to this world, be buried and resurrected in his likeness. If you'd like to do that this morning, to make your covenant with God, or if there's any other prayer we can offer on your behalf, please come forward and let us know what that might be as we stand and sing song number 284.
Leading us, Luke, to realms above, while the light from the throne shines for you and me, let us list to the call of